Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the World Atlas of Cheese by Nancy Erk of Stork, number 5, episode 5. We've found the weeping cheese, where's theatrical cheese, cows keeping warm, farm cheese, Swiss influence, fair imitation. Where's the theatrical cheese, going back to the Swedish theatrical cheese? Cold climate cheese for the smorgasbord, the Parsons cheese. Food for morning, Ost being cheese. Farmer to factory cheese, long winter. Sterilization. I have to get back onto it, The cheese cake is an amazing one. Weeping cheese. The theatrical cheese, where was it? Beautiful story of theatrical cheese. But now we're on to page 46, which is the Danish cheese, Denmark. And yes, royalty from cheese, cheese export markets, private place. So Denmark gets a fair story in here. So this is the World Atlas of Cheese. We've had the first couple of chapters where we've looked at the basic, we've told you, we've educated you enough about the different types of cheese, what goes into it, the curds, the actual ripening, the processing processes. As I go, I can't quite still remember, there's a bacterial working away at it, which it's part of the ripening process, and they eventually die out, or they produce gas for producing bubbles. It's a separation technique where the milk is, the whey is separated from the curd, curdle, so to speak, and the whey, the various fats go into the different components. I have to really think about it. I sort of am remembering the chemical process where casein is a chemical, and the enzyme operating on the casein protein turns it from water soluble to insoluble, and then that protein has been, by repulsion, keeping all the fat particles out in suspension. Okay, Denmark. To produce the cheese in quantity, quality, and a variety, you need large herds of dairy cattle. These in turn demand wide acres of lush pastures encouraged by temperate climate. This is why Denmark, of all Scandinavian countries, is by far the most important producer of cheese. Unlike Norway and Sweden, it has no rough mountainous countryside. The highest point is only 170 metres above sea level. Well, this is wrong. It says only 170 meters, 1.3 miles. Not correct. Mistake there, Nancy. Watch what you're doing. And nearly everywhere is given to green fields of fertile soil. A bitter winter can suddenly turn into mild spring with sunshine and gentle rain. A more favorable climate for farming and cattle raising is hard to imagine. Denmark's agricultural policies came about as a result of two main factors. To begin with, an intensive reclaiming of sandy heathlands and marshes eventually provided large areas of fertile grazing, and compensated for unpromising mineral wealth, the lack of industrial raw materials. The second factor, Denmark occupies a very advantageous position in the North Sea and the Baltic, and lies on the path of several important trade routes. Today, about 95% of the land area is cultivated, and there is a well-organized system of cooperative farming. Denmark has become one of the world's great producers of bacon, butter, cereals and meat, and of course, cheese. The Danish food industry has also benefited from the fact that the Danes are people with healthy appetites. The average dairy diet is the richest of all Canadian countries. Anxious to promote Danish dairy products, the Danes have developed a very high standard of hygiene and control, result that Denmark has inspired great confidence among many other cheese importing customers. Cheeses of prehistory. Some of the earliest settlers in Danish mainland were primitive tribes from Finland and Lapland who arrived more than 4,000 years ago. Archaeological finds show they kept goats, sheep, cows, and Atlas cheese to form part of their daily menu. The Danes became skilled at the art of cheese making, learning from other countries, especially technical appropriation skills, which they generously shared and spread across abroad to the agents of the Vikings. Denmark was the real homeland of these fierce sea warriors, and it is likely that the inhabitants of the regions in which the Vikings permanently settled became familiar with Danish cheeses, perhaps also with the cheeses from elsewhere in Europe, which the Vikings, like many modern tourists, brought home in their ships. The next important influence, that's right, Raider Monastery, where are you going? Forget the wine cellar, I'm going to their cheese cellar. Well, here we go. The next important influence on cheese came from the Cistercian monks in the Middle Ages, who developed new methods of manufacture, which they passed on to farmers, landowners in the districts, and farmers and land adjacent to the monasteries. It is not strange that the first simple cheese series were found particularly in the Middle East monasteries. The Cistercians were forbidden to eat meat and experimented to find a nutritious replacement. Avoiding the use of rennet as a starter, they found the leaves of certain insectivorous plants, possibly genus Dasura, the Venus flytrap, and sundew, could be used instead. Oh, wow! Wow! The juice released by these plants to dissolve trapped insects contains the same enzymes as the rennets. It's just the most delicious story. The monks probably taught the farmers the art of manufacturing cheese in addition to making fresh ones. Gradually, goat's milk and sheep's milk were replaced by cow's milk. Smoked cheese, status cheese. Scandinavians developed a taste for certain smoked goods following the need to preserve and thus smoke their fish. It was a short step to smoking the cheese. The finished fresh cheeses were smoked over straw and hay fire in open air. Such cheese were Frinsk Rygost. Traditionally a farm cheese is now mainly produced in factories, where the curds are conveyed in aluminium containers through smoke chambers. Afterwards, cumin seeds can be added, either sprinkled on the curds or mixed with them. The cheese does not mature and can only be kept a few days. Originally, farmers made cheese for their own consumption and for use as currency to pay the taxes levied by the church. It's likely that many European churches were built, as if it were, on the foundation of cheese. Dun, 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 dun. As the town began to grow, the demand for cheese increased, and production kept pace. Among those considered to be very experienced cheesemakers were the inhabitants of the islands of Samsø, which was Danish cheese world-renowned. The annual production of Denmark butter and cheese during the first half of the 13th century reached nearly 60 tons. The province of Thy in the north of Jutland, which is Typo cheese, takes its name. A cheese became a status symbol. The larger the cheeses, the greater the professional skill of the makers. On this skill, the prosperity of the region depended. Some cheeses reached such colossal dimensions that several men could hardly lift them. Royalty from cheese. During the reign of King Christian II, at the beginning of the 16th century, religious observant held that it was forbidden to eat cheeses during Lent. Oh no! I thought it was meat, but now it's cheese as well. Poor Christians. Christian's position was somewhat ambivalent. He was the upholder of the faith, but he was also a champion of Danish cheese, and those Danes who took the trouble could obtain from the king a special letter of dispensation, for a suitable fee, of course, by which cheese and religious observance became reconciled. Christian was responsible for considerable improvement in the quality of Danish cheese and other dairy products. Deciding that industry needed foreign expertise, he sent some Dutch farmers, cheesemakers from Needham, who settled to the island of Amager near Copenhagen. In the same manner which the Finns absorbed some of Switzerland's cultures, the traces of Dutch influence in the Danish cheese industry can be clearly found today. The first export market. The Dutch cheesemaker's example had an inspiring effect on the Danish cheese industry. Many landowners who were previously only interested in horses became involved in the dairy farming. On the estates and the large farms, cellars were turned into cheese dairies, where an even temperature was maintained throughout the year. Production demanded a greater workforce, and ripened cheese piled up in cellars in such quantities that it outstripped the demand. However great that latter was, new markets had to be found. Cheese was an early expert finding its way to Britain before the 19th century, where its highly flavoured aroma was much appreciated. Elgersted and Tystrup were exported from Schweigen-Holsten, then part of Denmark, albeit in small quantities only. The Danish cheeses of the period differed from region to region. They were both firm and soft cheeses, spicy and simple. As often happens in the course of progress, many have disappeared forever. No, I have lost my cheese. Cheese pioneers. In keeping with the practice of many European cheesemakers, experiments were starting to attempt to produce foreign types of cheeses for the home market. Around 1800, Constant Brunn, owner of the Anfox estate, invited Swiss cheesemaker to make Emmental from an entire milk yield of his dairy cows. Although production was successful, Danish Emmental gradually developed into a smaller cheese with a character all of its own, the present Samson. On his Beckhoff's estate, Baron Shelby adopted British methods of cheese preparation. He did not press his cheese underneath stones, as was the normal practice, but used screw press. The young engineer Jorgen of Karpstrup also became famous as a cheesemaker. With a fine example of Dutch, Parmesan, Swiss and cheddar cheeses, he started the Danish cheese world by publishing his manufacturing secrets with a frankness unknown since the days of medieval monks. Of all the great cheese pioneers, the most important was Hans Nielsen, born in 1829. Nielsen was a countrywoman. Hannah Nielsen was a countrywoman who was interested in farm produce, so interested that she purchased a farm named Havarti. That's H-A-A-V-R-T. Cheese Hanny Nielsen from her husband and decided to make cheese. Undaunted by her lack of foreign languages, she travelled abroad to study cheese making. Returning to Havarti, she started to experiment with Norwegian goat milk cheese, English cheddar, Dutch Edam and Gouda, French Camembert and Roquefort, Eastern Prussian Tilts, and Swiss Emmental. Her farm, which gave her name to the modern Havarti cheese, was soon producing enormous quantities of the cheese, some of which was sold to the royal court. In Denmark, her influence was far-reaching. She found time to give lessons in cheesemaking to farmers' wives, who turned taught others, so that constantly increasing the home industry became a chapter in the country's agrarian history. Foundation of cooperatives. Around the year 1880, Denmark had three types of dairy establishments in existence: small farms, estates, where local milk was made into butter and cheese, and small cheese factories, which processed the milk of associated farms. Originally, the best cheese came from estates. Most farmers felt more secure concentrating on crops rather than dairy farming, and many grew wheat for export. But towards the end of the 19th century, grain prices fell by 40% due to an enormous export activity of the now superproductive wheatlands of the New World, North America, Australia and Argentina. The Danish farmers could only survive this crisis by shifting to dairy and meat production. But to achieve competitive prices for the dairy products, they would have to work through close cooperation. In 1882, the first cooperative dairy factory was opened at Haging in southwest Jutland. 6 years later, 125 of them had been established throughout the country. While some operated as private concerns, most maintained the cooperative system. A further stimulus to trade was the invention of the centrifugal cream separator, among other technical improvements which enabled butter to be made on a much larger scale. These kinds of improvements also helped the cheesemakers to improve their products. Denmark's world exports. Even before the 19th century, Denmark was a dairy country of world repute. But it was her butter rather than her cheese that attracted foreign buyers. Relatively little attention was paid to the cheese production, which would only satisfy the home market. Cheese was available in a variety, but not in quantity. This state of affairs persisted until after the Second World War. Then, owing to land consolidation, progress in combating cattle disease, and establishment of cooperative stables which would hold over 400 cows, milk production greatly increased, despite the decreasing number of farmers. Those farmers that remained concentrated on raising cattle that provided both meat and milk, especially for the black and white Frisians, a fine milk and breeding stock, and to a less extent the Jersey cow, with a high fat milk suitable for butter making. Jersey is also very economic. It is a relatively small and requires little food. Today, cheese factories have completely taken over the production of the farmers. The milk from the farm has been collected by modern refrigerated tankers. Denmark has grown in importance and has become the third largest cheese exporter in the world after Holland and New Zealand. Pride and pace. And Kiwis. Oh my god, the Kiwis are up there. Foreign influences still can be found in Danish cheese varieties. The establishment of the national range was originally based on the cheeses from foreign countries, mainly from Europe, yet eventually took on a genuine Danish character. Due to the properties of Danish milk, Sampso began its career as Emmental, but later became unmistakably Danish. As a further step towards establishing foreign Danish cheeses, the authorities decided to change the names of many types, especially those with foreign origins, to those which might be confused with other Scandinavian cheese. Thus, Danish Emmental means Sampso, and after the island in Kattegat. Port du Slu became Ersum after a town where it was made. After all the members of the Sampso family, which were made in different towns or districts, such as Mols, Thy, Finn, were given the prefix of Bo. So, in that Finn Bo means from the island of Finn. Finn, or Funin, incidentally, was the home of Hans Christian Andersen. I knew he was cheese related. Ha! To these we can add Molbo, Elbow. There is a national Elbow and Tybo, and Maribo, which are named after the town and island of Lolland. Most Danish cheeses, therefore, have rightfully been given their own names, which were officially recognized in the Convention of Stresa in 1951. What are you here? I'm here for the cheese convention. Cut. And come again. Sampso and Danish cheeses with Swiss origins are round like the cartwheel, sharp edges, and weighs approximately 14 kilograms. It was a full cream cheese, a paste with firm but not hard, a colour which is pale yellow. It has shiny shoals or eyes the size of cherries, and a fine nutty flavour that varies from sweet to strong, depending on the duration of ripening. Some prefer to eat it as soon as it has been made, when sweet and very mild, while others maintain that the age improves the flavour. A 6-month Sampso, cut into generous portions, has a full, rich flavours of such distinction that it really encourages the old European saying, cut and come again. I really wonder what those European languages were saying, all that kraut language and stuff like that. The Sampso family. Sampso became established as the grandfather of all Danish cheese types. It's typically Scandinavian in spite of its Swiss origin. While it's not being counted among the really great cheeses, it's extremely versatile. This is not a really great cheese. Looking its character to a number of descendants, Dunbo differs from Sampso in shape, being square instead of round. Well, and sometimes contains, wait for it, there's more pages here, caraway seeds. Well ripened up to 2 years, spice Danbo is called Gramlost, and is considered a specialty. Finbo is round like the Sampso, but smaller and without sharp edges. It's a product of the island of Flynn and has eyes which are somewhat smaller than the original Sampso. The mild, aromatic Elbow, with its very firm paste, is made from a loaf shape and has fewer holes. Tybo is the most solid-looking member of the family. It's half the size of Elbow. Molbo is the last member of the clan, a round cheese with a red wine. What a waste of space that cheese is. The distinct nutty aroma is immediately apparent on cutting. Highly flavoured and wildly expert, Molbo as the firm is consistent with Samsung. Most of the cheeses are made in a varying fat content, so usually between 20 and 45%. All varieties of Samsung lend themselves well to cooking and is therefore useful in the kitchen. Well, there you go. Oh dear, this is disgusting. This is a picture of a man suckling a cow. A statue of Danish mythology in the square of Fraberg on the island of Flin. The statue is called Jambon and stands over a well. According to myth, the Scandinavian giant Ymir and the cow that fed him were the first beings to be created. Ymir, also called Rhyme Giant, was the embodiment of the primeval Karis. He was eventually slain by Odin, who created the world, and Ymir's body, from Ymir's body. The sculpture made by Kjarnes in 1913 and was cast in bronze in 1964. Well, there you go. It's certainly an ugly looking piece. I think he's got a big thing over. Okay, Ursum and other semi-hard types. Samsøls are not the only semi-hard cheeses found in Denmark. I was about to say, what? Only one semi-hard cheese, but there's more. There's the Gouda-like Maribor. Is either flat and round or square in shape and full of very small holes due to the curds being crumbled, kneaded, and then salted. Maribor is a red paraffined rind and is made of fat contents between 20, 30, and 45%. Its paste is yellow, to reddish yellow in colour. It possesses a distinctive flavour with a characteristic, quite pronounced aftertaste. Havarti, one of the most heavily exported of all Danish cheese, is a loaf of cylindrical shape and rather like a tilsit. The rind of Havarti can be left dry or washed. As the cheese ages, the washed rind makes the taste of this cheese, originally flesh and slightly sour, somewhat sharp. In the monastery town of Erzrum, the monks used to make excellent cheeses, which was later forgotten, and the monastery is now in ruins. But the Danish Dairy Research Institute has rediscovered Erzrum. This full cream cheese, probably finer and richer than the original, was deliciously sweet to taste. Its paste is golden yellow in small holes, and washed rinds give the cheese so much flavour that the lovers of Erzrum will advise you not to cut it away, but eat it with the cheese. Well, I find this hard to believe. So this, we've got the University of Ars resurrecting a cheese, or making it, what's it, Jarlsberg, making Jarlsberg viable, and they've reinvented here, these cheese scientists. Blue vein specialties. Denmark makes a selection of blue vein cheese, whose origins were greatly influenced by examples of Rokava and Gorgonzola. The most famous Danish blue is Danablu, which is excellent cheese and has achieved worldwide fame with the help of very skillful marketing. The consumption of Danish blue in England far exceeds that of Stilton Blue Chelsea. Danablu was first produced before World War I, when the Danish cheesemakers were experimenting with various types of mold cultures. Realizing that the mold in the cheese is similar to that which grows on stale bread, a cheesemaker by the name of Maurice Boll introduced a bread mold culture into the high fat cheese made with homogenized milk. He was thus invented Danish blue, and judging by its enormous success, he too deserves a statue in his honor. Well, there you go. So, bread. Danablu has come in several types. Cylindrical, rectangular, and tender square. Its fat content is 50-60%. The paste ripens swiftly and looks milk white, with a delicate network of blue-green veins. Danablu cuts easier than one would normally expect from such a soft cheese, even though it has sometimes been rather crumbly. Its flavour is very pronounced, often distinctly sharp. If you find it too easy, it can be improved by crumbling and mixing with butter or cream. In this form, it spreads easily on sandwiches. It is also a favourite of Danish accompaniment to meat. Marcella, it sounds like a biological component. It's a larger cheese, milder on taste, and more yellow in colour, with a vein nearer the green than the blue. It's different mould than that of the dark blue, and it's called Marcellum, which gives the cheese the name. That's right. Marcellum is a mould cheese. I thought it wasn't. Marcella is the name of the mould, which is characteristic of Gorgonzola. A part of the production of the natural cheese type, Denmark continues to make imitations of foreign varieties of Camembert, Brie, Emmental, Sempelin, Mozzarella, various whey cheeses, Heiteros, cottage cheese, and Flodros. Flodros. Cream cheese. Schmorlbrod. The Danes are champion cheese eaters. You know, just know you or anything else. They're going to be good cheese eaters. On average, they consume 10 kilograms per person per year, mainly on open sandwiches. The famous Schmorlbrod. Schmorlbrod and the Swedish Schmorgasbrod are vaguely related. The first means butter bread, while the other means bread and butter table. Both are ways of presenting a variety of food, fish, meat, eggs, and cheese, all at the same time, in an attractive fashion as possible. The origin of the Schmorlbrod are obscure, but it's said to date back to the 16th century, and probably earlier. And it's simply been a way of displaying wealth and abundance and hospitality. For the Schmorlbrod was almost certainly confined to the merchant class and nobility. It should be remembered that separate courses such as were unknown in the 16th century, as were forks and table napkins. Perhaps the Scandinavians were among the more civilized nations when it came to table manners. This may be why the famous opium sandwiches are today tackled with a knife and fork. Cheese, of course, is a very popular ingredient of these opium sandwiches, and may be combined with other foodstuffs such as chopped eggs, mushrooms, bacon slivers, shrimp, smoked fish. These are tastefully arranged with practiced skill on thickly buttered bread, usually rye bread or white bread. The Danish ambassador. The consumption of cheese has increased to such an extent that a large proportion is marketed pre-packed. For this purpose, the cheese is made slightly drier than normal and allowed to ripen in the package, which prevents the rind from forming. The remaining moisture is retained, but the gases are able to escape. All cheeses for export must be provided with the Lure mark, denoting it has been passed with state quality control. The mark shows the interwoven horns, or lures, which in the Bronze Age form a wind instrument used only at ceremonial occasions. It was applied on a casein disc, which additionally records the fat content and coded production date. The label grows to form part of the rind. So let's work this one out. This is printing that I can't quite understand. Let's read this one again. It's applied on the casein disc, which in addition records the label grows to form part of the rind. Before definite export license is granted, the cheese is once again inspected, this time at the border. A Danish cheese, after all, is an important ambassador.
Halt! Have you got the cheese? Come on, show us the cheese.
This is my understanding, is that they grow a mould label on it. Let's go, here's the names. Danbold, Danablu, Danabo, Elbo, Elsrom, Finbo, Finchrengost, Havarti, Marbo, Molbo, Masia, Samso, and Tybo. And the most massive cheese you can buy is the 14 kilogram Samso. The lightest cheese you can possibly buy is the Ertsum, which is in a loaf. Iceland. So Iceland is a place of one cheese, and it's called Skyr. Skyr. Iceland. The northern point of Iceland just touches the Arctic Circle, above which each day and night lasts half a year. I think Paul Urquhart-Stork, that's not the, I don't think she's really understood it. Is that true? Each day and night asks half a year. No, that would be true, say, I think above it is that there's the days have become so short that you get a couple of days without a night, but I don't think that's true. Let me have a think about that. And the dark winter seas are covered with drift ice. The island is covered with volcanic plateau and over 100 volcanoes, many perpetually capped with snow. Much of the island is covered with solidified lava and huge glaciers. Turbulent rivers create spectacular waterfalls and hot volcanic geysers spew rocks high into the air. I'm sure she's not been there. I just got to really think about that. I think that's unlikely. Much of the island, for centuries, the inhabitants of Iceland, a country owned successfully by Norway, Denmark, were left to their own devices. They fished, they practiced agriculture, and they raised cattle. During 120 to 130 frost-free days a year, both the food of the islanders and the fodder of the cattle were coaxed from the most fertile acres on the land. In winter, the small communities were completely isolated. Each family depended on its own herd of sheep, which have always been better equipped than cattle to endure harsh conditions. Sheep provided meat, milk and wool, ideal stock for the farming family, and had to supply its own needs, and even today there's hardly a farm without them. The Icelander have proved that despite the barren rocky wastes and the northern climate, the land can be worked and yield adequate and even abundant food, but it has taken centuries of hard labour. The latest development is the growing of vegetable flowers and even subtropical fruits in glasshouses heated by thermal springs. Early accounts of the Icelandic cheese appear in the old sagas, where we find the mention of Skye, a fresh sheep's milk cheese which was made from farms all over the island. In later centuries, farmers learned to improve the keeping and quantities of cheeses with the aid of rennet. Whey cheeses, the Norwegian Myfoss, remains one of the standard varieties both farm and factory produced. Skye is usually made from skim milk left over from butter making. The tepid milk is curdled or started with Skye from previous day. It's then quickly cut and set aside for an hour or so. So I don't quite understand. I really don't understand that. I thought whey appeared when you curdle milk, but now you're telling me that you actually. I don't really understand this. The following day, the residue whey is removed, and soft, fresh curd-like skyr is ready to serve. This is actually not curd. Whipped up with milk and thickly sprinkled with sugar, it's eaten in vast quantities. Children love it. Was it Lazytown? Nowadays, since the dairy foods have become an industry, the main product of Skye takes place in the factories. First farmers' cooperative date back from as far back as 1882. The modern Iceland boasts 19 dairy factories, presses the milk from the island's highly productive herds. Since the 19th century, Danish cattle have been grazing the scarce pastures, and Norwegian cows were introduced even earlier. Small, rough and hardy, the present cattle have now adjusted perfectly to Icelandic conditions and provide excellent milk. The island's dairy plants produce various cheese types, including Tils, Gouda, Malbo, Orlost, Baby Swiss, Gradhost, Blue Swede, and Camembert, Porcelain and Massinger, soft brown cheese. Their quality is high in keeping with the up-to-date factory equipment and the fact that Iceland's cheesemakers have profited from their foreign experience. But as far as the world of cheese is concerned, the simple traditional sky still remains the island's most important contribution. So, I mean, that's the entire thing. You just can't be an imitator. You've got to go in there and really produce important cheeses. Cheese of renown. Now, this is a picture of England with certain, I'll just read it, the Blue Vinny, Capri, Cheddar, Cheshire, Derby, Dunlop, Gloucester, Double, Lancashire, Leicestershire, Stilton and Wensleydale, 10. I just see what they mean, but where is Wensleydale? Oh, it's the Pennine, okay. For the succession of British poets, there have never been enough words to describe the English landscape, which can change not only from county to county, but from mile to mile. In the east, the land is flat as a tail, the soil is black, and the roads of the Fen Country right stay true, run straight and true. There comes a gradual confusion of hills and forests, the meadowlands, villages and towns. Ignore the big cities and follow the rolling, twisty roads. They'll take you to the mountains and valleys of the Wales, or they will skirt the Penn chain of hills. The spine of England will take you to the north, rocky highlands. There, the coastline is indented with deep, narrow estuaries called friths, in contrast to the wide, placid rivers of England. From the seaports along the coast, seafarers and explorers swarmed over the globe, and wherever they went, they left a small corner of Britain in every foreign field. And possibly a cheese recipe or two. I was going to be like that cheese recipe. Britain is steeped in traditions, and its institutions, from parliamentary democracy to fish and chips, have become known all over the world. But the British have often been among the first to start important new developments. Chief among these was the Industrial Revolution. It began here in the 18th century when farm workers, hoping to escape rural poverty, sought to work in cities and found urban poverty increased. They left the farms by the thousands and the cities began to expand. Yet, in spite of ensuing urbanisation and industrialisation, a great deal of Britain remains rural and agricultural. The country is rich in cattle and sheep. It has a true maritime climate, mild winters and cool summers, the perfect conditions for dairy farmers. It's not surprising then that Great Britain has several unique cheeses varieties of superb quality. Yet because British drink large quantities of milk, they are obliged to supplement their equally heavy cheese consumption by importing cheese from abroad. Over 130,000 tons of cheese are bought in each year. In addition, 119,000 tons are produced at home, which is only 3% of exported. Everybody in England, regardless of class, eats cheese. For as long, along with bread, bacon and beer, it has been a staple of well over 1,000 years. It's beautiful Britain. Mm. Of the English cheeses that have survived the passing of time to take their places amongst the great cheeses of the world, there is less than a dozen. The most popular and widely consumed cheese is unquestionably the Great Cheddar from the country of Somerset in the West Country. Here is a reason where for centuries cows have grazed and cheese has been made. Somerset, together with its southern neighbour Dorset, supply well over a quarter of all the cheeses produced in England and Wales. The lovely landscape of Somerset rises abruptly in the northeast to the Mellip Hills, where the stalactite caves and winding narrow cliffs known as Cheddar Gorge leads to a small village of Cheddar. The village, with its souvenir shops for tourists, is not particularly memorable, yet it is the cradle of the world-famous cheese, one made locally on numerous farms as well as in the adjoining parishes. The history of English cheese. In the Middle Ages, a farmer and his family were mostly entirely self-supporting, living mainly on the produce of the farm, which included buttermilk, butter, whey and cheese. Whether they made cheddar as we know it today is an open question. The question I want to ask, were they producing cheddar? What were they doing? in Civil War, all that sort of stuff. But cheddar cheese was already in demand in the Elizabethan period when it was described as an excellent cheese with a delicate taste. Cheese was then made from both sheep's milk and cow's milk. By the 17th century, a preference for cow's milk was thoroughly established. Traditionally, farmers or labourers made common cheese of his own consumption, a low-fat skim milk cheese which turned very hard and crumbly. But there were others who made whole milk cheese called rich cheese, luxurious golden yellow varieties, solid local gentry in the manor houses or in the nearby market town. Someone's underlined this one. It was made from full, fresh morning milk mixed with cream from the previous evening. With skimmed cream from the previous evening. That's really interesting because they have different amount of fat content. No wonder this morning milk or morning cheese was described as long ago in 1855 as the best in England. Not unnaturally, attempts were made to copy it on a cheaper scale. Farmers and merchants began colouring their simple skim cheeses to give the appearance of a richer variety. In some parts of the West Countries, cheeses were dyed with saffron, long cultivated as their food flavouring as a dye for homespun yarn. In the 18th century, it was found that the extract from the fruit of a West Indian tree, the Bixa orana, was cheaper used than saffron and more permanent than carrot juice. This dye, called anatta or anatto, is still the most satisfactory way of colouring cheese. The most notable example are the bright orange Leicester and the Scottish cheddar. The bigger the maid, the better the cheese. In the good old hit-or-miss days of cheesemaking, when Britain was entirely agricultural, most cheeses were made traditionally buxom roast-cheek dairymaid. There were milkmaids, too, equally endowed, who featured in English folk songs. In fact, their lives were hard and their work was tedious. When no milkmaid was available, the dairymaid had to milk the cows herself. Every morning and evening, she was responsible for the upkeep of the dairy equipment, she was required to have perfect knowledge of cheesemaker's art. How to treat the milk, prepare the curd, press the cheese. Before pressing could begin, it was of greatest importance that the vessels be firmly filled. The dairymaid achieved this by climbing onto the lid of the cheese vessel, then pressing down on the curds with her hands, using the full weight until most of the whey had oozed out. This pre-pressing was essential because the primitive cheese presses of the day were unable to cope with the moist curd. As the old saying goes, the bigger the dairymaid, the better the cheese. They've underlined this one as well. Okay. In the spare time, when the dairymaid prepared rennet for the stomachs of cows, churn the butter and tend to the ripening of the cheese. Owing to the intense work program, mishaps occurred with the ripening cheese. The rule was then, save what can be saved, because cheesemakers were ignorant of the critical temperatures and acid percentages of moisture content. Cheese had to be saved as often as may. As far back as the 17th century, when the production on farms increased, the neighbouring farms of the cheddar district began to work on a more or less cooperative basis. The collective milk output was taken to a cooperative dairy, and from it cheeses from 20 to 120 pounds were made. According to the size, they could be kept between 2 and 5 years. Towards the end of the 17th century, a lot of the cheese trades were developed across the country and abroad, and considerable profit was made in the cheese districts. And it continues, pages and pages of cheddar production. This is a special cheese as a family secret. Apart from the cooperative cheese, the majority of cheddars were farmhouse cheese. The quality varied greatly, as did the recipes for making them. Recipes were closely guarded, family secrets passed down from mother to daughter. In the second half of the 19th century, a widespread reform was heralded by Joseph Harding, who showed the cheesemaker a more enlightened system of production. His slogan was, cheese is not made in the field, nor in the byre, or even the cow. It's made in the dairy. What Hardy was taught became known as the cheddaring process. The curd is cut into pieces in the normal manner. When most of the whey has been excelled, the curds are stacked in a vessel to form a thick blocks of parcels. These are then turned about and folded, releasing much of the moisture as possible. Temperature required for this process is approximately 37 degrees Celsius. These pieces in the meantime become very firm, tender like breasts of chicken. Now for the moment the milling has arrived. Formerly, the dairymaid tore the curd by hand to small pieces. At the end of the 18th century, curd mill was invented, making the task somewhat lighter. The milled curd is placed back in the vessel, stirred and salted, and finally pressed into the mould. After maturing, the cheese should have a close, but not hard, texture without eyes. Nowadays, farms that make their own cheddar are a few and far between, and the ones that sell it are even fewer. Important customers such as the court, restaurants, and special establishment in London clubs have regular orders of cheddar. Cheddar the Great Traveller. The traditional farmhouse cheddar used to be made between April 1st and November 1st, but is now made throughout the year. It's usually produced with the milk of a specific breed of British cow, the Shorthorn. The cheese would have a firm, elastic consistency and slightly nutty flavour. It must neither be too sweet nor too sour. It should ripen for at least 6, but preferably 12 months or longer. The real connoisseur eats mature cheddar with fresh blood, bread, brown or white, or crackers, butter, sweet pickle, or gherkins, crispy lettuce or celery, or a glass or two of hard cider. Cheddar is also an excellent companion to English draft beer or good bourbon. But then, what isn't? Well, because she's a bit of a malt soaked person. Since the middle of the last century, cheddar has been made a cheese the factory known as creameries. Today, there are more than 30 spread right across Britain. Factory cheddar is usually eaten at somewhat less mature age than farmhouse variety, from 6 to 8 months. It's very pleasant, mild flavour, milder and less sharp than tasty farm cheese. It melts easy and is therefore popular as one of the varieties used in the Welsh rarebit, where the cheese is cooked with a beer to make a thick sauce and then poured over buttered toast and browned under the grill. Of all the British cheeses, cheddar is the biggest production sales and consumption figures. Its fame has reached beyond the British Isles, travelling with immigrants to parts of the world where cheddaring process has been established. Thus we have the New Zealand and Australian cheddar, the New York State's cheddar, and even, it is whispered, French cheddar. Quelle trompe! The cheese further owes its foreign success to the fact that it travels well and keeps it excellent quality for a long time. British Gruyère. Yet another reason for cheddar's popularity is the application to processing. Many varieties of processed cheese use cheddar as a base, owing to its great acidity and wide appeal. Qualities which it shares with Gruyère, another favourite of processors. Cheddar has always been a cheese demanding much time and investment, if only because of its long ripening period. It's evident that, like so many other difficult regional cheeses, cheddar might have vanished forever, a victim of technical progress and economic efficiency, had it not been for a providential occurrence. The doomed cheddar found a benefactor. A fresh cheese from Wales. Oh, gee. Cheerfully. This is getting it. Cheddar was about to go. Well, cheese has saved cheese, as far as I can see. Page 57. You're waiting for it here. This is 100 years ago, the fresh Snow White Calipari cheese was made twice daily on nearly every farm. Contrary to the usual practice, the morning and evening milk were never mixed in making cheese. Most of it was eaten on the farm and the rest was sold around Cardiff. Caerphilly was very popular with the miners because it was easily digested in fine cramped conditions and being very fresh, it did not dry out at all. How did Caerphilly Caerphilly whiskey cheddar. Compared to most other British cheeses, Caerphilly was quite modern, perhaps no more than 160 years old. It was named after the village of Caerphilly, where it was the first made. Cheese rapidly became so popular with Welsh farmers, finding it impossible to cope with the demand, turned to the help of the late 19th century to the neighbours across the Bristol Channel, the cheddar makers. It too came to be from two different types of cheese were produced on many farms at Somerset. Traditional cheddar, a cheese that demanded considerable labour and long periods of ripening, and the canopy requiring less milk. A cheddar requires 10 times as much weight and milk as canopy do. The offering a fairly rapid turnover. Canopy could be sold after 5 to 10 days. The cheddar makers could thus wait patiently for the cheddars to ripen. Canopy is a soft, fresh cheese with a mild, slightly sour flavour reminiscent of buttermilk. It's easy to cut into slices and can go well on some salad, breads and butter and celery. So, that meant that they had a dual use. They could do it. Okay. Customary rolling of Cuba Hills of the Gloucester City. The figure wearing a white coat and a tall hat as the master of ceremonies, decorated cheese bounces down the hill, pursued by a crowd of children. The ancient custom is used on Midsummer's Day, but has now changed to Whit Monday. Well, there you go. Thanks for telling us that. Single and double Gloucester. Along the Vale of Gloucester and the Vale of Berkeley is the land of Gloucester cheese. It's likely that the cheese had been made here for over 1,000 years. The cheeses are known as Gloucester or Berkeley cheeses, probably according to the district in which they are made. They came in two sizes, the generous, well-matured double Gloucester and the thinner, milder single Gloucester. Of the two, only the double has remained, perhaps because the cheesemakers, keeping an eye on expert markers, appreciated the large proportions and good keeping qualities, as the double Gloucester never comes short in spite of its long ripening period of 6 to 12 months. Old Gloucester are ancient cheeses. They are only established as a popular type at the beginning of the 18th century, owing to the treatment of the rind. The floor of the curing room was regularly rubbed with The floor of the curing room was regularly rubbed with bean and potato stalks, leaving a wet black deposit. The processes were placed on this and turned twice weekly, which made the rind tough as leather and improved the keeping properties of the cheese. Well, then came the widespread practice of colouring cheeses with carrot juice, by which was hoped to convince buyers that it was the rosier cheese, the richer was the milk content of the milk. Still later, the cheesemakers decided to enhance their products further by painting the rinds with red ochre instead of traditional black treatment, sometimes mixing pigment with beer. Today, cheese is usually fine with natural, uncoloured rind. The handsome red cheeses featured in festivals to mark the beginning of spring. They were decorated with flowers and carried through the streets to the small village of Randwick, which played the Anglo-Saxon, which in Anglo-Saxon means dairy farm on the hill. There you go. An additional testimony to the lineage of Gloucester cheese. A similar folklore is even still celebrated at Cooper's Hill near Gloucester City on Monday, when cheese's wheels are rolled down the hill among great festivities. Cheshire cheese is cheddar's great rival. Many declare it to be the oldest of all English cheeses. That it was also famous cheese is evident from the fact that Cheshire was mentioned in the Domesday Book, by which time it was established. The Roman soldiers on the 20th Legion garrisoned the town of Chester, possibly enjoyed the taste of the salted crumbly cheese made from milk cows and gradually superseding the shaggy goats that had grazed there before centuries. Cheshire cheese is named after the country through, although French, who have appreciated Cheshire for a long time, it's called Chester after the capital. Perhaps because the city was a large cheese market where the cheeses were sold for export. A particular appeal of the flavour of Cheshire cheese is due not only to the preparation and ripening techniques, but also to the quality of the region's soil. Also underlined, local farmers declare that Cheshire's meadows are the finest in England and perhaps the most unique due to the salt deposits found in the land below Netwich and Middlewich, dating from the period when prehistoric seas covered the area. Cattle that graze in Cheshire pastures are noted for the high salt content of the milk, which then endows the cheese with such characteristic flavour that it's impossible to imitate outside Cheshire. The cheese ripens slowly and possesses a fat content of 48%. Until the Second World War, the cheese was mainly farm produced. There's still some 20 farms making their own cheese, And fortunately, it looks as if their number may be increasing. Cheshire is made three varieties, red, white and blue, and said to endear itself to the Union Jack Patriots. White Cheshire is a quick ripening product which uses a larger quantity of rennet as the starter. It's pale in cream colour and milder flavour. In keeping its properties, however, a poor and turns acid in bitter flavour. The red semi-mature cheese is made in May to October. It's a mild, nutty flavour and is ready for sale after about 6 weeks. Anto dye is used to create an orange colour of this cheese. Blue Cheshire is the most totally different cheese. It's one of the greatest blues in the world. The invasion of blue mould is always accidental, although slightly encouraged. The cheesemaker never adds special doses of mould culture, but an expert eye selects the cheeses which seem to have a propensity for turning blue. He then places the cheese in a very humid cellar, screwing them occasionally with the hope the blue may develop in the air channel. His satisfaction is, oh my god, sorry, what, the most disgusting cheese I've ever seen. Excellent. Rare and expensive. The blue Cheshire cheese, note the holes where the cheese have been skewered. The mould may have developed the channels, thus forming the matter. Fuck, I just... It looks the disgusting cheese. It's like this revolting cheese. His satisfaction when the mould takes is considerable because his splendid cheese, quite equal to Stilton, has become rather rare and fetches high prices. A blue Cheshire cheese is distinctive in appearance as being orange and blue veined. It has turned from crumbly texture to ordinary cheese to a soft, buttery one with unique taste. There are no better compliments to crusty, fresh bread and far better than a fruity Burgundy. It's up to you. The good cheeses of Mrs. Paulette. Fortunately, devotees of blue cheese, there are plenty of Stiltons to supplement their lack of blue Cheshire. It almost sounds as if blue Cheshire would naturally be the first choice, but the majority of Englishmen, Stilton is the blue cheese and has aristocracy companion to port wine for over 300 years. Stilton, made in tall cylindrical shapes, weighing either 7 or 14 pounds, together with cheddar and Cheshire are amongst the most famous of English cheeses dating back to the 17th century. It keeps on going. Oh god, this is going to keep on going. Oh my god, it keeps on going. Some have suggested that Stilton may have been derived from goats and sheep's milk cheeses which blued like Roquefort and were made in the Vale of Belvoir in the Middle Ages. Popular legend is that Stilton was first made by Quinby Hall, Leicestershire, a country seat of Lady Beaumont. Her housekeeper, Mrs. Paulet, had a brother-in-law who was landlord of the Bell Inn in the small village of Stilton. She supplied him with homemade cheeses, which was surplus to the household requirement. The Bell was coaching stop for the Great North Road, and cheese soon became famous as Mrs. Paulet's cheese. The writer Daniel Defoe, however, reports that having enjoyed Stilton cheese in the Bell in the year 1720, some 10 years before the arrival of Paulet's cheese. Mm-hmm. That is something you read the novels. Well, surely Defoe is just making it up. The writer Daniel Defoe, however, reports, okay. Furthermore, there are others who claim that the invention of Stilton, notably Mrs. Orion of Little Derby near the Bilton Mowbray, at the origin of Stilton remains a mystery, but Mrs. Paulet's complicated recipe is still being used even this century until Stilton became a factory cheese. It's made of the richest whole milk after curdling, cutting and stirring. The whey is separated from the curds, which are salted and placed in deep wooden loops. The curd is regularly turned so adequate drainage takes place. Stilton is not pressed. After about 1 week, the curd is removed from the hoop, bound with calico and left to cool, moist atmosphere for another week. During the period, the characteristic brown rind begins to form. The cheese gradually becomes firm enough to keep its shape without cheesecloth. A fresh white Stilton is also made, a very crumbly, with a strong smell and flavour that is mild and gentle, yet sourish. Only in the cool, humid, ripening cellar does the blue mold develop. Fine steel skewers or needles are driven into the cheese, and the blue mold develops in the resulting channels to spread throughout. Still needs about 4 to 6 months to mature properly. Unfortunately, it's often sold when too fresh, when it is hard, white, chalky, and acidic flavour. Just as the firm of Hutchison in Whitchurch, Staffordshire, store and age their own blue Cheshires, so the world-famous cheese department of Fortnum and Mason in London stores its Stilton. Well, I missed London, I missed going to them. Cellars beneath the premises, assistants turn the cheeses daily and regularly brush the rind clean to avoid fungi and mite. 17th and 18th century, no such care was taken. Cheeses tend to be stored in damp, dirty cellars. And, interestingly enough, many connoisseurs did not consider the cheese fully matured unless it was swarming with the mites. When you consider the prevailing lack of attention to hygiene, even in the dairy, it was not surprising that many cheeses turned blue, and it was this blue cheese in particular that received the attentions of the mites. Today, Stilton and other English blue cheeses are made with fine quality milk and ripened in carefully controlled environments. Ripe Stilton should have a well-crinkled brown rind with a pale, slightly flaky texture. The flavour is smooth and mellow, much milder than other blue cheeses. The blue-green mould should be evenly distributed throughout. It is often inclined to be concentrated towards the centre. When the edges are brown, the cheese is fully ripe. And although Stilton is available all year round, it's best eaten from November to April, especially enjoyed at Christmas table. This way to cut Stilton is in a horizontal slice across the top. An alternate method is by scooping out the centre with a spoon. Causes the cheese to go dry and crumbly. This is sometimes remedied by pouring port wine in the cavity. But this does little to improve matters. Better to cut the moist piece and enjoy it with a few dry biscuits and a stick of celery and perhaps a glass or two of port or burgundy. Apple pie and cheese. That's another fine British blue made like Stilton with both white and blue varieties. This is the Wensleydale, a Yorkshire cheese of more ancient lineage. It is said that Wensleydale was made by the Cistercian monks of the now ruined Chevaux and Fontaines Abbey. That's right. So they were the same ones in Denmark. Like, from the original Norman recipe. This would imply the Wensleydale is perhaps the ancestor of the Norman blue, de Bresse. But many ways it is closer relative to the Roquefort or rather, it used to be a cheese that was originally made from the sheep's milk, as the great French cheese, or occasionally from goat's milk, whichever happened to be available. For centuries, the monks had upheld the tradition of agricultural breeding, dairy, and other dissolution of monasteries. By Henry VIII in the 16th century, they taught the cheese-making methods to local farmers' wives. It was sometimes during the 11th century that most farms turned to whole cow's milk. In those days, Blue Wensleydale would have been eaten on the Dale farms, along with the famous York ham and pieces of oat bread and havercake, alas, now extinct. Whatever havercake is. The local rival of Wensleydale cheese was called Cotherstone. It was made in a village that's name is Teesdale. It was also known as Yorkshire Stilton, and if it was still being made, it's a well-kept secret. The term Blue Wensleydale implies that there is a white one. This is indeed the case. A much bigger seller. White Wensleydale is often sold when very young. It has a slightly sour buttermilk flavour, not unlike carefully. Although cheese will taste the same too. Be honest. Making Wensleydale cheese requires careful attention. The great secret is the curd must be not turn sour. And this depends on the freshness and sweetness of the milk, the quantity of rennet and slow drainage of the curd. Slices of curd wrapped in calico are placed on a drainage receptacles turned every 20 minutes. When the whey is expelled, the curd is salted and put into vessels. where it remains overnight without pressing. The next morning, it's bound calico and pressed for just a few hours. The impression of the calico brand has silly see on the cheese afterwards. During ripening, the cheese, which is still very soft, is turned every day for the first few weeks, and later every other day. The recipe, after some months, has a velvety texture. The majority of Wensleydale cheese on the markets are white, unripened salt. Blue vein Wensleydale is a rare, fairly rare. It can be spread like butter and has a mild, creamy flavour. A daunting rival of Stilton has practically the same shape and weight, but differs in having a grey-white rind. In the north of England, apple pie and white Wensleydale cheese are a favourite combination. The saying goes, Yorkshire, apple pie without cheese is like a kiss without a squeeze. Another well-known verse occurs, but when I undress me each night upon my knees, I will ask the Lord to bless me with apple pie and cheese. Surely, they're not going to punch me with another page of Great Britain. I've done you. Don't force me. It's an hour and 5 minutes of cheese, and we've only done 2 countries. Oh no, it continues. Oh. Century ago, the most farmers made their own cheese. English cheeses were found of great variety. They say the railways put an end to the variety of milk could be transported in bulk to dairies, and the cheese became regional. While this remains true, the odd farm still makes their own cheese. Such local specialties as Bath cheese, Oxford sucks, it's said to be the world's hardest, Essex, Blue Cottenham from Cambridge, Daventry and Lincoln have disappeared forever. Only the great ones have survived. So it's said to be the greatest. Suffolk was said to be the hardest. The quality of Leicestershire has always been protected, as witness to the town cry of Leicestershire, who used to call out the list of fines and punishment for spoiling or adulterating cheese. In its crumbly structure, it resembles Cheshire's cheese, but receives much greater dose of anticoagulant to give it a familiar deep orange hue. On the cheese board, it contrasts pleasantly with others. Leicestershire is one of the finest and mildest English cheese. It reaches its peak of perfection after 6 to 9 months. As it melts, it's useful in cooking, especially Welsh rarebits. In the kitchens of scattered farmhouses and lonely hills in Lancaster, cheese is still made as of the old from a mixture of 2 days curd. The curd is kept for a fortnight, during which time the acid develops, responsible for the whiteness of the cheese. After passing through the curd mill, the Lancaster is salted and pressed. At present, the total of about 150 cheeses are made every week on the farms. The rest of it coming from the creameries. Lancaster is a ripe after 2 to 3 months and should be eaten at once, which means that practically the entire production is consumed in the immediate vicinity. A soft cheese, after 3 months, it can be still spread like butter, but it is by no means as mild, having developed a stronger aroma and more pronounced flavour than either cheddar or Cheshire. Like Leicestershire, the cheese melts easily, and for this reason is called the Lee Toaster, after the town of Lee near Manchester. The popularity of Derby cheese suffers from the fact that it closely resembles cheddar. Quite simply put, people prefer cheddar. Production on this fairly limited scale, and this cheese is not subject to the rigorous grating scrutiny of cheddars. Derby is a mild, pleasant cheese, a solid, hard-pressed type, with a fairly high moisture content. It's sold from 6 weeks old, when it's rather unripe, but the ripening defects from which it once suffered have now been eliminated, and a mature Derby, like any good cheese, is worth waiting for. There are flavour varieties known as Sage Derby, such as undergone several challenges in history. Originally, it was flavoured with finely chopped fresh chaise leaves and mixed with curd. The next development was to grind the leaves and add spinach juice to give the cheese a bright green streak through the centre, like a sandwich. Then the makers created a marbling effect, which is the current fashion. The original type is one more available in limited quantities, however, especially Christmas time. three countries, counties where farmhouse cheese is still made have united to form the Golden Cheese Horde of Farmhouse Cheddar, Cheshire and Lancaster. The Milk Marketing Board organises the production, and the English Country Cheese Council promotes both farmhouse and factory cheeses produced in England and Wales. Few other varieties have made such an importance in their own region, and are sometimes to be found on the shops of big cities, where they are appreciated as special cheeses. Regional specialities. More of a curiosity than a speciality, the Dorset Blue likewise is known as Blue Vinny. The word Vinny is derived from the Old English fins being mould. It's hard blue vein cheese, and was once produced in nearly every farm in Dorset from milk that had been skimmed by hand. Consequently, it was fat-deprived, and its chalky, loose consistency caused air pockets favourable for mould development. There are other factors too. In former times, the milk was often contaminated with dairy conditions. Unhygienic cheeses would be stored and shed together with leather horse harnesses and wet boots. Conditions ideal for mould development. Blue veining will occur in much more readily in full-fat cheese with more enjoyable results. And so the spontaneous growth in a Dorset cheese was a rare event. Even then, the cheese required 18 months to mature. It was said to be so hard that people in Dorset used to make locomotive wheels. Blue Vinny is now almost extinct. Attempts to revive it has been unsuccessful. It's possible to find a shop that sells the cheese purporting to be Blue Vinny, but simply more like second-hand or third-grade Stilton. In recent times, the number of new cheeses, some good, some bad, have appeared in the market. There is the upstart Red Windsor, a cheddar impregnated with wine, and still encrusted with walnut, not really to be taken seriously. A pleasant newcomer is Cabot, a full-cream cylindrical cheese covered with oatmeal made in Scotland. It tastes sometimes slightly sourish, nutty due to the oatmeal. There is also several small soft cheeses from the north of Scotland. Cathays cheese, Orkney cheese, Icy, from the Hebridean Islands of that name. The most famous of Scotch clan is certainly the Dunlop from Ayrshire. During the lactation period, the Ayrshire cows provide an amazing 11,600 kilograms of milk, nearly 40 litres per day. Dunlop is said to owe its existence to an Irish refugee of the late 17th century, one Barbara Gilmore, who arrived in Ayr and made her cheeses according to an Irish recipe. Not unlike cheddar, but light of colour and rather bland and moisture, even when well matured. Dunlop is usually eaten quite young, when only a few months old. It goes well with butter and oat cakes and Scotch ale. The modern younger generation of Scots seem to prefer a native-dyed Scotch cheddar, while the older generation still enjoys the rough-hewn country cheeses as the nameless farm cheese, flavoured with caraway seeds found in Aberdeenshire. Then there's Cowdery, a full-cream cheese made from country farms by adding rennet to tepid milk straight from the cow. As soon as the curd is formed, it is put in a colander, and the cheese cloth is left to drain. After some hours, the curd is placed in a basin and mixed with cream and a pinch of salt. It would be a mistake to suppose that the British farmers' wives throughout the country make cottage cheese and pot cheese to an extent of variety. A few do, here and there, especially in summer when milk tends to shower. But the majority go to the local supermarket and buy a processed cheddar. It's one of the sad facts of our advanced civilization. The British tend to be resistant to changes in daily diet. Although they have embraced hamburgers and spaghetti, they even manufacture their own spaghetti and, it's rumoured, export it to Italy, only the indigenous cheeses are made in the United Kingdom. One does not find a range of cheeses any clearly foreign origin. In this sense, all cheeses made in Great Britain are British originals, stemming mostly from ancient tradition, which has inspired a degree of pride and prejudice. The British seem to prefer their own cheeses to anyone else's. Okay, finishing that. Thanks a lot for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.